Think about the last time you opened a navigation app on your phone. Or, I mean, if you're old school, like unfolded one of those massive paper maps across your steering wheel.
Oh, yeah, the ones you can never seem to fold back up correctly.
Right, exactly. But when you look at it, there's this absolute expectation of, total objective detachment. You are standing at point A, you need to navigate to point B. And the map provides nothing but the raw, unfiltered geography.
Yeah, gives you a blue line for a river, maybe some green shading for a forest.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe some topographic squiggles to represent a mountain range. But the map doesn't care if you're like terrified of heights while you're crossing those mountains.
It is strictly utilitarian. I mean, it doesn't care if you are completely exhausted. It just coldly reports elevation and distance. It is entirely devoid of emotional intelligence.
Which is, well, it's incredibly useful for driving, but completely inadequate for actually living.
Oh, absolutely.
But imagine finding a map that went beyond topography. Like, what if you found a map that actually anticipated your internal emotional state at every single mile marker?
Now, that would be something.
Right, a map that could accurately predict when you were about to feel arrogantly self-sufficient and warn you, or, wrap its arms around you when you were paralyzed by terror in the dark.
And finally, promise an actual, literal, overflowing feast at the ultimate finish line.
Exactly. So, welcome, our beloved family, to today's conversation. We're just so profoundly thrilled you're taking the time to be with us because today we actually have our hands on exactly that kind of map. Okay, let's unpack this. We are looking at Psalm 23.
Which, it presents a really unique challenge.
Oh, for sure.
Because it is arguably the most famous piece of poetry in human history. I mean, it's printed on greeting cards, it's cross-stitched onto throw pillows.
Recited at nearly every funeral.
Exactly. And that familiarity can often breed a sort of blindness. We just stop seeing what the words are actually doing because we've heard the melody way too many times.
And that is exactly why we are turning to the profoundly moving sermon we are examining today.
Yeah, the sermon is incredible.
It really is. It strips away all that soft greeting card familiarity and reveals a startlingly robust start-to-finish guidebook for the entire human experience, from your very first breath through your darkest traumas all the way into eternity.
What's fascinating here is the sheer scale of the contrasting imagery the sermon highlights. I mean, it is staggering.
Yeah, break that down for us.
Well, we begin with this calm, quiet, almost fragile pastoral care of a shepherd tending vulnerable sheep in the mud and the grass. But the destination, it's the overwhelming royal glory of being a permanent seated guest at a king's banquet.
It is a massive swing in scenery.
Yeah.
So let's begin where the map begins, verse 1 and verse 2. The green pastures and the still waters.
Right, we are starting in the good times, the springtimes of life.
Yeah, the springtimes. And our mission today for you, our beloved family, is to trace this massive emotional and spiritual arc together. Through those springtimes, surviving the dark valleys, discovering a shocking linguistic twist in the original Hebrew, and uncovering the hidden cost of this ultimate comfort.
It's quite a journey. And regarding those springtimes.
Yeah, I genuinely struggle with the sermon's take on this phase of life because it suggests that these peaceful, prosperous springtime moments are actually considered the most spiritually dangerous times in our entire lives.
It's definitely counterintuitive.
I mean, I have to push back on that a little. We spend our whole lives trying to achieve that peace, right? We work decades to save for retirement. We
Yeah.
buy home security systems.
We eat our kale, go to the doctor.
Exactly. We do all of that specifically to avoid the valleys.
Yeah.
So to call peace a hazard feels, I don't know, almost ungrateful. How does the sermon reconcile that tension?
Well, it requires us to look really honestly at human psychology, what the sermon calls the illusion of self-reliance.
Oh, that's a great phrase.
Because human nature is incredibly predictable in this regard. When we're healthy, when the promotion comes through, when there is absolute peace in our homes, our first instinct is rarely deep, dependent gratitude.
Yeah, we tend to pat ourselves on the back instead.
Exactly. We look around at our beautiful, lush, green pastures and say, wow, I really cultivated a magnificent lawn. Look at my brilliant landscaping.
It's totally the arrogance of success. It's like someone being born on third base and thinking they hit a triple.
That is the perfect analogy.
They're standing there feeling incredibly accomplished, completely ignoring the fact that they didn't even swing the bat. The health we have, the natural talents we possess, that fleeting peace we occasionally enjoy, they are pure, unmerited gifts. They aren't our resume.
No, they're simply the shepherd's provision. And the sermon reminds our beloved family to think deeply about the specific metaphor being used here. We are not the engineers or the landscapers. We are the sheep.
And sheep are not exactly apex predators.
Not at all. Biologically speaking, sheep are notoriously weak, dependent creatures. They literally do not have the physical capability to independently scout out green pastures.
Right, they certainly can't dig their own wells to create still waters.
Exactly. They lack natural defenses, no sharp claws, no venom, no real speed. Their survival depends 100% on a shepherd physically carrying or leading them to those places of provision.
So that total dependence in the green pastures creates a terrifying vulnerability, really, because eventually the weather changes, the landscape breaks down.
Which brings us to verse 4.
Yeah, the most famous and terrifying part of the map. We go from still waters directly into the valley of the shadow of death.
This shift is just jarring. And the natural question is, if the shepherd is so good, and if he's supposedly in control, why are we suddenly walking in the dark?
Right. Why would he ever let us leave the pasture?
The sermon answers this by grounding the poem in actual historical shepherding practices of the ancient Near East. A real historical shepherd deliberately leads the sheep through those dark, treacherous ravines.
Like, deliberately?
Yes. In regions like Judea, you have these deep, incredibly steep canyons known as wadis. During the intense heat of the late summer, the grass in the lowlands completely burns up.
Oh, so they have to move.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The only way to keep the flock alive is to move them up to the high mountain mesas where the snow melt keeps the vegetation green.
And the only physical route to those high mesas is straight through the dark, narrow wadis.
You got it. So the valley isn't a mistake. The sheep aren't lost, and the valley certainly isn't a punishment for bad behavior. It is a necessary, albeit terrifying, route to reach ultimate survival and growth.
Wow, that reframes the suffering completely. The valley has an absolute life-saving purpose.
It does.
But down in that canyon, the psychological experience of the sheep changes entirely. The sun is blocked out by the canyon walls. Predators are hiding in the rocks. The lush grass is gone. They can no longer see the provision. So what do they rely on?
They transition from relying on the shepherd's provision to relying on the shepherd's presence and protection. That's why the imagery suddenly shifts from grass and water to the rod and the staff.
The mechanics of those tools are actually fascinating. The rod is essentially a heavy club, right? Used as a weapon to aggressively fight off wolves or lions.
Yes, and the staff is the longer stick with the crook at the end. It's used to gently hook a wandering sheep by the chest and pull it back onto the safe path, or rescue it from a crevice.
Which leads to a really poignant detail from the sermon. The idea that deep, unshakable trust is rarely formed in the sunlight.
It really isn't. You cannot build a bulletproof reliance on the shepherd just by reading books about shepherding or even by listening to beautiful teachings.
True trust is forged almost exclusively through personal pain.
Exactly. It is forged when you are in the dark wadi and all the things you normally rely on, like your money, your specialized skills, your social network, they are all utterly useless. You have to rely solely on God.
So what does this all mean for us when we are isolated by illness or failure or broken relationships? I want to pause here for you, our beloved family. Practically speaking, this is where the map hits the road.
It really is.
When you are feeling profoundly isolated, you know, stuck in a sterile hospital room waiting for biopsy results that could change your life, or navigating the shattered ruins of a marriage, the darkness feels absolute. Isolation is the most suffocating part of the valley.
Yet the sermon offers a deeply practical, beautiful image to combat that isolation. Think about the instinct of the flock. When sheep are deep in a canyon and they hear a wolf howl echoing off the rocks, they don't independently scatter into the darkness.
Right. That would be a disaster.
Exactly. Their biological instinct is to huddle together. They press their bodies close to one another.
From the shared body heat and just the physical reassurance that they aren't alone.
In the exact same way, during our valley moments, we are designed to share our crushing burdens within a community of faith. We are never supposed to suffer in stoic, prideful isolation. The shepherd's rod protects the flock from the wolves, but the flock itself comforts each individual sheep.
Oh, that's beautiful. So we endure the wadi. We lean on the shepherd's rod. We lean on the physical presence of each other. But as we finally emerge from the canyon, the map does something completely unexpected.
Yeah, it really does.
Here's where it gets really interesting. We don't just walk out onto another slightly higher grassy hill. The entire metaphor completely shatters.
The sermon points to verses 5 and 6 as this dramatic, almost disorienting pivot. the pastoral imagery just vanishes.
We're no longer livestock following a man with a spick.
No. Suddenly, we are elevated to the status of a VIP guest sitting inside a royal palace.
You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. It is such a bold, almost defiant, triumphant image.
It is. A grand, lavish banquet.
But I have to admit, I always found the subsequent imagery, you know, the anointing of the head with oil, really weird.
Oh, sure. In a modern context, it sounds very strange.
Right. Yeah. If I invite someone over for a dinner party, I don't greet them at the door by dumping a bottle of olive oil on their head. It feels messy, sticky, and just uncomfortable. What are they missing here?
Well, it requires us to step back into the blistering, arid climate of the ancient Near East. When a guest traveled for days through the dust under a punishing sun, their skin would be cracked, they'd be covered in sweat and grime.
And probably relentlessly plagued by flies and insects.
Exactly. So a wealthy host would greet an honored guest with heavily scented medicinal oils. Pouring this cool oil over their head was a physical relief. It instantly cooled their body temperature, acted as a natural insect repellent, and the rich fragrance masked the stench of the journey.
Oh, wow. So it wasn't just some bizarre ritual. It was a deeply practical, luxurious act of physical healing and shielding.
And combining that cooling, protective oil with a cup that is intentionally poured until it overflows onto the table, well, these are massive cultural statements.
What is this king actually saying there?
He is loudly declaring, I have infinite resources, and they are entirely at your disposal. Imagine the psychological security of this scene. All the things that just hunted you through the dark valley, the fears, the medical diagnoses, the literal enemies, they are standing right outside the banquet hall.
Yeah, they are right there.
They can see through the windows, but they are completely paralyzed. They cannot touch you.
Because the king himself is hosting you. It represents a permanent, eternal safe haven where we will never be forced to return to the dark valleys again.
Which sounds incredible.
It does. But my anxiety immediately kicks in. How do we guarantee we actually make it out of the valley and into this heavenly banquet? Because I know my own track record. I get distracted. I deliberately choose the wrong path.
We all do.
Right. So the famous concluding verse says, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. But does that gentle, polite English word follow really capture what's required to get someone as stubborn as me to the palace?
The short answer from the sermon's linguistic analysis is a resounding no.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the gentle English translation vastly undersells the intensity of the original language. The original Hebrew word translated as follow is radarf.
Radarf.
Yes. And radarf does not mean to politely walk behind someone like a shadow. It actually means to relentlessly pursue or fiercely chase down.
Wait, fiercely chase down?
Yes. It is an intensely aggressive, almost terrifying verb. Historically, it is normally used in the context of an invading enemy army hunting down a fleeing soldier, or a curse violently falling upon a sinner.
That is wild. It's an attack word. It's an apex predator word.
Yet here, the subjects doing the fierce, aggressive hunting are God's goodness and mercy.
It is the ultimate paradox of grace. Even when we deliberately betray the shepherd, even when we stubbornly sprint in the complete opposite direction, God's goodness and mercy act like relentless pursuers.
Like divine bloodhounds.
Exactly. They simply refuse to give up until they catch us and bless us. We aren't just being politely guided, we are being chased down.
Consider how that completely changes the dynamic of our spiritual journey. It utterly removes the crushing pressure of us having to perfectly navigate our own way through the dark valleys. We arrive at the king's table not because of our brilliant navigation, but because he simply will not allow us to escape his grace.
But stepping back, that raises a massive, unavoidable theological collision.
How so?
Well, this level of relentless, aggressive grace, how can we possibly deserve to be chased by blessings? If we are ruthlessly honest about our own selfish actions, our betrayals, our pride in the green pastures, we've actually earned the curses.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this brings up the ultimate theological core of the sermon, the absolute reliance of Psalm 23 on the events of Psalm 22.
Explain that connection for our beloved family.
Well, ancient Jewish audiences didn't read these poems as isolated chapters. They were ancient hymns, memorized and sung sequentially. For the original audience, Psalm 22 bleeds directly into Psalm 23 as one continuous thought.
So they're completely linked.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we only get the overwhelming blessings of 23 because Jesus Christ took on the prophesied curses of 22.
The contrast the sermon highlights between the two psalms are just devastating. Like in Psalm 23, the sheep are led to the cool, refreshing, still waters.
But in Psalm 22, the prophecy describes Jesus suffering extreme thirst on the cross, his tongue sticking to the roof of his mouth so that we could have those still waters.
And in Psalm 23, we receive the physical comfort and impenetrable protection of the shepherd's rod and staff.
Yet in Psalm 22, the prophecy explicitly describes his bones being broken and pulled out of joint so that we could have that protection.
And then we reach the most profound contrast of all. In the terrifying dark valley of Psalm 23, we are promised God's constant abiding presence. I will fear no evil, for you are with me.
But Psalm 22 opens with Jesus facing utter, agonizing abandonment by God. My God, why have you forsaken me?
He was entirely forsaken in the ultimate, darkest valley of human history, specifically so that we would be guaranteed God's constant presence, so we would never be alone.
Exactly, because the Good Shepherd willingly took the curse we deserved, we are now entirely free to enjoy the overflowing blessings. He absorbed that wrath, that relentless pursuit of righteous judgment.
And now, as our resurrected high priest, he is the one actively preparing that eternal banquet for us right now. The royal king who prepares the lavish table is the exact same shepherd who bled and died for the sheep in the dirt.
The cross literally paid for the feast.
The cross paid for the feast. That is the ultimate comfort drawn from the sermon. It no longer matters if your current path is a lush green pasture or a terrifying shadowy valley.
The surrounding terrain will inevitably change, but the character and the presence of a guide never will.
In every single situation, the good shepherd is right there in the dirt with you, holding the staff and absolutely refusing to let you go. So to our beloved family listening right now, we want to remind you to trust in this relentless love. It actively, fiercely hunts you down to bless you.
It's an incredible promise.
It really is. And before we close out our time today, I want to leave you, our beloved family, with a final provocative thought to ponder on your own.
What is it?
Sometime this week, I want you to look back at the most painful, difficult, exhausting valleys in your past, the times you felt the most broken or isolated. And ask yourself this, were those actually the exact moments when you were being fiercely chased down by grace, even if the darkness made it impossible to see it at the time?
That will definitely change how you view your past.
Absolutely. You aren't just wandering aimlessly through the canyon, you are being relentlessly led home. Thank you for spending your time with us today, beloved family. Keep walking, keep huddling together, and we will see you next time.